And I'm actually pretty thankful to have like a critic of that at home. Poetry is not Brent's bag. And so sometimes he'll say these funny things, and I'm eventually going to write a poem about that. Things like, why can't you just say what you mean? I'm like, I thought I was, just like in all the wrong words. And then when you were mentioning Rumi, I have a journal at work, so sometimes if I can't think of anything profound to journal, I have a few quotes that I'll just rewrite to help like cement these things in my mind that I do believe, but sometimes I forget. And I wish I could remember who it was. I think it's Yeats. And he said, you know, I wake up and I'm struck by the beauty, and I have a hard time deciding whether to enjoy the beauty or like to plan to make more of it. And so where do we find that divide of like, there is so much beauty in life, and sometimes we need to enjoy it, and sometimes it's our job to make it. And so Rumi just sort of made me think of that. My poem is not really about either one of those things, I guess. It's about thin spaces. So I talked a little bit about this at the church service on Christmas, and it's an idea that I was first introduced to by Tim, and it's a Celtic tradition, but arguably it could be, you know, the idea of it is found in so many different cultures, that there are places in the world, and sometimes it's like actual physical geography that you're like grounded to. Sometimes it's just opportunities where you feel like the space between like you, this single entity, and like the enormity of the universe, like that space is just diminished, and somehow you're closer to it, and you can experience life in a different way. So, like, I would love to just have my life be that experience, but sometimes I have to do things like fold laundry, you know, and that's not particularly profound. So most of our life is like, you know, just like that life stuff. But every so often, you know, you might reach one of these spaces. And for me, I never know when that's going to happen. Like, I can't really plan for it. I mean, I think some people do. Some people physically plan to go to these locations where other people have had these experiences. I'm not at a stage in my life where I can just, like, get up and travel to these places right now. So I just have to wait for these experiences to come to me. And I don't think you can even just wait for them. They just sort of, they happen, you know, if you're lucky. And so I had one of these moments last year. Our division did their first ever powwow, like a division-wide powwow. And I took a group of students. I facilitated a group at school, so I didn't lead it. I've had like a fantastic series of different Indigenous leaders come to the school and lead it. And I've just sort of facilitated like permission forms and stuff. So I got to go to this powwow, and it just poured. It was like the coldest, worst day ever. And so everybody huddled under this one big tent, and like there was some misery because it was cold and horrible. But when I looked around, especially at the elders, like that wasn't the experience of that place in that time. There was just this, like this togetherness and resilience and joy. Like I think the joy really is the thing that like would be the umbrella over all of that. And at the time I thought like I can't really like get into this because I'm busy making sure this kid doesn't eat peanuts and die, and I'm making sure that this kid doesn't run away because they might. And so like I was sort of wrapped up in that. But as much as I could, I tried to just feel it, and then I went back to it later, right? And I really was trying to grapple with like a lot of this experience for me was experiencing a connection to the land and history and being Indigenous from the outside, right? So we're all on different journeys towards reconciliation and what that means for us, right? And I feel really quite privileged as an educator that in a lot of ways we're at the forefront of this because of the system that we're in. Like our system was the residential school system, right? And if you look at the calls to action, schools are a big part of that reconciliation. So we've had a lot of opportunities to be educated as adults to how do we do this? What does it mean? What happened? Where do we go? So I was lucky in that moment that I had some stuff, you know, already with me in that moment to sort of look at it from different ways. So I was just really trying to look at it from the land, like where are we physically right now? How is this important to where we are, where we're standing? And part of that, too, is Tim had mentioned, I think it was maybe Davis had taken a class on Indigenous themes, because most universities require this now, to have a course like this before you can graduate. And the idea was that the land is like Jesus, right? It's like it's central to the whole belief system is the land. So I thought, like, I need to get into this. If this is the land that I live on, if I live on Treaty 1, I need to understand that, you know? And I don't say I understand it now. but I'm trying to, because this is where I live, and I think it's important, and I think that grappling with that will make me better, and, you know, it's part of my path to reconciliation. So this is a lot of where this poem was based. The poem is called Two Cities, and there actually is nothing about a powwow anywhere in it. It's just me trying to interact with different parts of this city and different experiences I had. So it's called Two Cities. And I think I'll just go ahead and read it now. Okay. Two Cities. One. Two cities overlaid. Fingerprint touch and map each other's contours. Always absent-mindedly aware of a textured intimacy. Two cities whose ribs open and breathe in the same infinite flex of geometric time. Iridescent, identical doulets, suspended, static spiraling and visifluid permeable, saturating, collapsing, gone. Two. While traffic wind whips barren bark elms, sentinels who stand witness, record with rings of exhaust-stained flesh, prairie-dried pulp, and half-life grow in the double decay of cement-divided roadways. An arrhythmic land chokes, heaves herself out, as dust-driven colonial chatter echoes through potholes. Three. Easy wind thins through tongues of grass. Dandelion wishes whisper wait. Ready with butterfly stomach secrets, the always earth laughs with upstrung trees whose roots share an inside joke. Folding in, accordion out. Arterial. Four, abysmal. The land is cut by living ribbons of red. Muddy waters surge and gutroil. Mute, the river's self-swaddling oppression. Unspeakable truths coil in clay, bound in unseen darkness. Too slick quick to fish. Instead, a trick. The river rings ripples of moving sunshine. Vanity-sized mirrors travel north-south. Reflect flashes of what is already surface seen. Fresh, crude sutures, palm-pressed, quilted. Five. Now close-eyed wait. Night disrupts day. Thickens and unmeters our memories. Night belongs to the land, brings intrinsic reorganization to misaligned imaginings, restoration of linear fear, knobby jointed, a skeletal kinship advances order. Flat, we spider legs splay, brazen, intangible, in tandem. Here, here now, two cities, one city. So if you don't know, the city is Winnipeg. So what I really got out of that experience is I really felt, like going back to the original experience of being at this powwow, that where I live here in Winnipeg, like there's two cities going on at all times. There's a city that I live in as, like in these systems where I have power that an entitlement and privilege that, like I was never aware of growing up, right? I can walk downtown in the middle of the night and more or less feel safe and have people view me as just somebody out for a walk, you know? When I yell at my kids and I'm parenting, I'm just a good parent. When I let them run amok, I'm also just a good parent. And that's sort of like the privilege, right? So this is like mainly the world that I live in. And mainly the Winnipeg that I experience, but I really feel it like there's another Winnipeg that's here that if we get into it and like unpack this idea of being like living with the land and being connected to it, like physically connected to it and interacting with it. I think that's the other part, is interacting with it. There's another Winnipeg here that sometimes I feel like I might get a glimpse of, if I'm lucky. And so that's why it's the two cities. Like there's two physically right here, and I mainly can just exist in one. But if you let go of some of that stuff, if you learn to let go, that maybe you can see and experience some of that other Winnipeg. So that's mainly what part one is going through, is setting up that there's two of them here. And they're here all the time. And I tried to really contrast that with like there's some images of like the infinite flex and geometric time, like these concepts, like what does that even mean, geometric time? That's not a real thing, right? But maybe it's just not a thing because we don't know it, we don't know how to experience it, right? And then these really dark things, like in part two, the barren bark elms. If you drive up Main Street, there are these beautiful trees that just like stand there dying because they just stand there with cars like driving past them all day. And so some of this I was writing when I was at St. John's Park around there. And if you sit in St. John's Park, especially in the summer, there's so many trees that if you're close enough to the river, you don't even know there's a city there. Like you're just with the trees and the grass and everything else. But you walk a little ways in and there are those trees in the middle of the road, right? So that really struck me when I started to think about it, is how much of the city are these sharp contrasts. Just even looking out these windows like this, I find this architecture like totally beautiful, right? These old buildings, but they're kind of dark, they're kind of dirty, right? They're not growing, they're there, they're kind of stained. So that's kind of what I was thinking about in part two, was I guess more of like our structures that we've put in. Part three. Oh, this was really neat. So I was sitting in St. John's Park, and in the springtime all the dandelions were growing, right? And then they poofed out to their seed heads. And the wind was like just right so that none of them were flying off. But they were all just like quivering. And I thought, like, you know, my kids are obsessed with blowing them and they get a wish, right? Or like, I don't know, however many wishes or seeds, however you want to think of it. And all these wishes were just waiting. And then it was like all these plants somehow knew that they were just waiting, and it's spring and that joy of springtime. And then it made me think, wow, like these trees, like there's all this stuff going on underneath we can't see and everything's moving, but it's like we have to care to look at it. And if we don't care to look at it or think about it, we could just walk by and see a tree, right? But there's all these things going on that we need to stop and think about. And then I thought the poem was done, and I brought it to somebody at school, a retired teacher who substitutes. And She had a very different take on it that I didn't really go with, but she said, you need the river. If this is about Winnipeg, how can you write a poem without the river? And at first I was mad, because I'm like, but it's perfect. So then I thought about it, and the river to me in Winnipeg, there's a lot of pain in the river, you know? You can't see into it, right? There's a lot of mystery and darkness, and it moves quickly, but you don't always see that. Like, you can look out, but underneath there's so much going on. And particularly in the North End, when I think of the river, one of the names that comes to mind is Daniel Taurasi. It was a child who was playing on the ice, and he fell through, and they didn't find him. You know, they looked, and they didn't find him. And I was thinking, like, there's so many things hidden in that river that we just don't know. So that's what I was thinking of for part four. Because some of the things that we don't see in the city, they're not always good, right? And then I thought I was done again, and then part five came to me. And it was this idea that even there's a lot of control issues, I think, with colonialism, like, and especially one of those things is we think we can control the land. It's sort of like the tenement of, like, we come over here and we flatten everything out and farm it, which we need, right? We need food, but we cannot control the land, right? Like, just in life, control is an illusion anyways, but we really can't control the land. And at nighttime, if you can't see what's out there, like, how frightening is that to be in the woods and you don't have a flashlight, right? You can hear, but you can't see. And so that's like the great equalizer, right? Is that night takes all these illusions that you live in this, like, nice little city with these nice little buildings, but you don't. This is the land. And you just have to recognize that. So those are the different parts. Who are we? it's everything.
I don't know how to ask little questions.
No, that's fine. I don't think poetry is about little questions. We spider legs play. Yeah, I don't know. I had this image when I was writing it of, like, this enormous spidery thing walking around, right? And this, like, going up and down. And it sounds like super artsy and, like, hippy dippy, right? Where you're like, I just have this image in my head of an enormous spider. But I think sometimes you just have to go with that, right?
And then somebody asks you a question, like, who are we?
Yeah. And you're like, oh, no.
Well, and partly
this is the
question,
truth of it.
Yeah, and partly the question for me came from when I experienced a poem, mm-hmm. it's sort of this beautiful moving between, let's say, material and immaterial, mm-hmm. not real and unreal,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
But the things we take in through our senses as humans, we tend to think about as reality, mm-hmm. which is a really curious stopping place, given how much energy we spend as a species on things we would call spiritual,
mm-hmm.
right? Intangible but real.
Mm-hmm.
Is often the way we experience those things. And so one of the things that I think poets do and that art makers do is they make thin places,
mm-hmm.
which is what you've done, at least in my experience with this poem.
Mm-hmm.
You've made a place with the things that you have access to for the things that are not so easy to access,
mm-hmm.
right? Made a space where we can kind of engage with that stuff and reminded us that we're surrounded by occasion for that,
mm-hmm.
but we have to take the opportunity mm-hmm. or make the opportunity. I was fascinated by the image in the poem of the intertwined nature of the things that we don't see.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of use this metaphor of the trees mm-hmm. and the roots and those things. At least that's the image that stuck for me. When you think about an image like that, about the interconnectedness of things below the surface, are there ways it reminds you of the interconnectedness of things above the surface? And if so, what sort of things come to mind?
Well, I think as soon as you said that, I thought relationships, because Like, we can know the roots are there. We can believe the roots are there. We can even, like, dig down and find those roots. But you're not going to do that with every tree and everything. You just sort of have to know they're there. And I think that that's sort of like our relationships, that when you make a connection with someone, like, it can be as real as that root, like, spidering out, right? Yeah.
It requires imagination, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because if we make a connection with another human being, we might think, well, that was a lovely moment, or maybe mm-hmm. not lovely moment, but
yeah.
it was substantial. And we felt the sense of connection. But unless we engage our imagination,
mm-hmm.
we're probably not going to think the next thought, which is, wait a minute, they're connected to someone's,
mm-hmm.
and I'm connected to someone's, and that moment of connection between the two of us is actually part of that whole...
Mm-hmm.
the interconnectedness of mm-hmm. all things,
mm-hmm.
right? And so science, of course, feeds into this conversation, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Everything's vibrating, the bits and pieces are being exchanged mm-hmm. all the time.
Yeah.
But sometimes we have to get to the stuff we can see
yeah.
to kind of go, oh, you mean like that?
Yes.
Right? So that's
yeah.
what the poets do
mm-hmm.
for us, I think, in no small part. That's what you do with a piece mm-hmm. like this, is you give us some images for that thing that we're experiencing, but unless we stand back and think about it, we don't have an image for it.
Yeah.
And imagination,
mm-hmm.
that's what we need. We
mm-hmm.
need an image.
Yeah.
Right? We need a picture in order to kind of start to wrestle with it or think about it or take it into our lives. How does having an experience like, or a series of experiences like you've kind of worked through in the poem, how would you say that changes your experience of moving around in the city, of just being in our town
mm-hmm.
here in Winnipeg?
I think you just watch things differently. I wish I had like an opportunity to just do that, to just walk around and watch everything, mm-hmm. you know. At this point, my life is still taken up with making sure nobody runs into traffic.
Yeah, you're watching something, but it's sort of immediate
yeah,
and pressing.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. I think maybe it just gives you opportunity maybe to see how other people connect either with themselves or with the land or... Yeah, I don't know if that really answers your question.
Well, it may have been a poor question as well.
That's a kind answer.
I'm just owning it. you're an educator
mm-hmm.
by profession. You're together with Brent. You're a parent.
Mm-hmm.
Your life is full of the lives of these young, you know, energy bundles. And you when you were talking about the process of writing the poem,
mm-hmm.
In particular the last part, I think, if I remember what you said correctly, and you said, and then the last part came to me.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do
mm-hmm.
to make space for, and the last part came to me?
Yeah.
Because I could be wrong, but I'm pretty mm-hmm. sure it wasn't while you were like grabbing for a hand
no,
to keep
no.
them out of traffic, right?
Yeah.
So what's that look like in your life?
I think... It's sort of like a hangnail. It's like you have this moment where you're like, there's something bugging me, it's irritating me, and I can put it off for now. I don't have to deal with it now, but I don't want to forget about it. And you sort of like, you sit there and you rub that hangnail all day. And you're like, oh, this still hurts. Still haven't resolved this. Yeah, and so for me, it's usually, it takes me like maybe a day or two or more to figure out what is this actual thing that's bothering me. And maybe bothering is not the right word always. Sometimes it's like, what is this thing that's exciting me or that I don't understand yet? Or sometimes it is something that's bothering me, right? And so I'll take that idea and I'll just write down like every word I can think of that goes with that idea. And that's sort of maybe where this like paper and pencil crayon stuff comes in. I don't use pencil crayons. I'm saying that like with that tone because I just was forgetful and forgot to bring pencils, and I feel bad about that. I had to use pencil crayons. But I'll write down like everything I can think of, like what is this thing that I'm trying to get at? And then I'll cross out all the words that, no, it's not that, it's not that. And then if there's some words that I think I'm getting close, then I'll think about that word or those few words and write everything about those few words that I can think of. And then usually I can sort of narrow down what it is. And then once I have, like, this is the thing, then I can expand out upon it. And how do you make time for that? Sometimes it's just, like, before I go to bed and I'm exhausted, and I just sort of try to write it out. Sometimes I have to make intentional time and, like, put other more important things aside, sorry, to the laundry and the vacuuming in my house. It's never convenient. Like, you always think, I'm going to sit down and do this artistic thing now, and then that's the worst time, right? That's when you can't do it.
I feel like that's that sentence, Karen, I think just for me anyway, summarizes a really important principle of seeing the world differently. Contemplation is never convenient.
No.
Like, I just think that's a reasonable truism, you know? Like, this is a deliberate effort because the everyday business of life will happily usurp time for reflection.
And I think, like, we live in a society right now that really values busyness, right? Yes. So unless you're doing something, unless you're doing something all the time, if you're just sitting there staring at the wall, like, you're not going to win any Nobel Prizes, right? Like, in our culture of what we value. So that's very hard, because sometimes I would like to just sit and stare at the wall and think, right? But if my principal walks outside the classroom door and sees me through the window, it doesn't look very good. So I'll just close my blind.
I have to manage my creativity.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's interesting that, I mean, I agree with all of what you just said about our culture affirming busyness and productivity as measured by, you know, GDP or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, some kind of an output criteria. But we're starting, it feels like in the 21st century West, we're starting to realize that some of the best things that we make only happen if we contemplate.
Yeah.
They only happen, call it deep work.
It's like this slow thought.
It's slow thought, whatever. Yeah. We have new phrases that sell books about it, right? But the idea is ancient.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that if we actually deliberately make space for those deeper connections, that's where our imagination can engage more fully, and where we actually have a different experience of the world, which is what spiritual wise people have been saying, do this, like, forever, right? This is not new.
Yeah.
Might have a new title, but it's not a new idea. But when we're not getting a lot of affirmation from our boss or, you know, however we measure our output for it, it takes some extra effort for sure.
Yeah.
This is one of the reasons why I love that we take moments like this in our life, right? This is one of the simplest reasons I can think of why showing up for community of exploration is worth the time. Because it actually makes some moments like that. You know, it actually kind of elbows some things aside. Sasha's across the hall making elbow room for us this particular morning.
Yeah.
You know, in some ways, if we're parents with little kids or whatever. So that's a pretty beautiful thing to get to experience. Well, do you want to haul out the pencils and the...
Okay.
So, like with our breathing together or any other practice at the table, please do not feel obligated to do any particular thing. I was talking with somebody recently about meditation, and they were like, you know, I try, but what I'm expecting from it just doesn't happen. And I sort of feel like ripped off, or like maybe I'm doing it wrong or whatever, and kind of abandon ship and come back again later because you really want the thing that people say can happen out of this particular practice, but I'm not getting it. Well, yeah, I mean, I hear you, and there's no substitute for giving it a go either. So if you feel like you're open to whatever Karen's going to offer us here as an exercise, then just jump in and give it a go. You may not be the next Rumi. And that's okay. But you might.
Yeah. And you know, I think, like you're saying with meditation, that's a lot of this for me is just like this struggle of what is going on in my life. What do I need to examine more carefully? It's not really always about the input of like, I want to get this perfect poem so I can share it on a Sunday morning. It's me wrestling with different things that are going on. So this would be like my meditative practice, right?
Yes, exactly.
Because when I meditate, I fall asleep.
Right. Well, meditate's a big word.
It's big,
like spiritual is big.
Yes.
You know, it's got lots
of
room.
When I do that traditional thing of what you see on TV,
right.
I fall asleep. Boom. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, over to you. Take it away.
So I feel like this is a moment where I'm having like a teacher moment where I'm like, I should have had two stacks of paper. I should have started them on two sides, given more clear instructions, because I don't want to start unless it like appears that we're ready. But you can start thinking. You can start thinking without paper. So maybe I'll give you like a few starting points of things that... Like maybe themes that have come up in my writing that maybe seem universal, or at least seem universal to me. So let's go back to the idea of place. Because maybe you have had one of these moments where you feel like you've encountered a thin place and like a time that you were just, you were really up against something that you knew was more than you. And maybe that's your, you know, your vantage point into what we're going to do. Maybe you want to think about like a relationship in your life and like a profound moment. And that doesn't have to be a good one, you know. Like I think I've maybe written like one love poem ever, and I don't think it was very good. I find love to be very hard to write about, but maybe you don't. So maybe you want to think about a relationship. Maybe you want to think about something that's bothering you. Like you had an experience that you just felt it didn't go the way you wanted it to, and why was that? And then just start writing down words, because there's no wrong words. Like this is all just an exercise. Like what you write down, nobody's going to come by and mark it, right? Nobody has a red pen. You just write down what you want. Lisa, I love that you've grabbed like several colors there. I'm totally calling you out. I love that. And maybe words are not your thing either. Maybe you know, every time I see people do great visual art, I'm like, oh, I wish I could do that. And then I just go and write words about it. Doesn't mean that I haven't tried to draw things, because sometimes it's good to just sort of get outside of your bubble and your comfort zone. So maybe that's what today is. Maybe that's just get out of your comfort zone. Oh, thank you, Corrine. There we go. I hadn't thought of that. I should have brought my clipboards from school. These organized things I could have done. So I feel like this is a moment at school where I would have, like, if the kids were like, I have nothing to write on, I would have said something like, solve your problem, be a problem solver instead of a complainer. And I would have given them like no options, just figure it out. It's just sometimes a good skill in life. And if you have a bunch of words, like you all look like you're really working hard here. That's great. Maybe you want to cross a few off. I don't know. Sometimes I just connect them. I'm like, oh, this word is like this word. I want to keep those two together. And then sometimes I just like smash words together. I don't know if you know the poet Dennis Lee at all. He first started writing children's poems like Alligator Pie. Alligator Pie, if I don't get some, I think I'm going to die. But he writes poems for adults too, and they're very challenging. And he will often take words and just chop them up and put them together and make new words. I did that a few times in there. I did Invisifluid. So you can do that too. Like there's no rules. This is one thing I love about poetry, is that you get to break all of the rules and then people think you're doing something fancy. Even if they don't tell you that, I can just feel that way, right? So there's no rules about how you feel about it either. Yeah. I would actually have a very hard time sort of kind of doing this right now. Like at some point in my process, I have to just get a good thesaurus and look through it for all the words that I know but I can't think of too. sometimes that's a rabbit hole where you get farther away from what you're thinking about, but sometimes it can bring you back to where you're trying to get. And maybe now that you have some words, maybe you have an image that's coming to you. And then sometimes when I have like a few words or a few lines written, I just try them in different orders. Because it's amazing how you can change a word order and it's a totally different thing. I also kind of like when I feel like I'm getting close to the right words and the right things that I want to say, I have this experience of like, this is exactly it. Like, this is the precise thing I'm trying to do. But like Jason was saying this morning, and I'm trying to think of how it came up. You have different ways of looking at it where you could look at it at different times during the day, and it could mean different things, right? Different people can look at it and it can mean different things, even though you feel like you're saying exactly the same thing. And that, it's not the right word, but I'm thinking the hypocrisy of that you're saying exactly the right thing, but people can believe different things. That can exist in poetry too, right? Just another reason why I like it. So keep your paper open, close it up, take more paper, throw it out, do what you want, because in the end, it should be for you, right? This should be for you.